Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. It's just.
Welcome, everybody, to the first meeting of the Joint Committee on Transportation. For the record, it is November 15th, 2017. First item we got up is the adoption of committee rules. I think we've all seen these many times before. To get it on the record, the chair would move adoption of the committee rules as presented. Discussion on a motion?
Second.
We don't need that, but okay.
Good.
Is there any opposition to the adoption of the rules, to the motion? Seeing none, the rules are adopted. All righty. Patrick, we're up. Invited testimony. Do we have any? We don't have.
Well, yes, we do not, Mr. Chair, although...
Well, now your face is
I believe...
Double negative, yes, we do not.
Yes, we do not. That's transportation.
I believe, Mr. Chair, how we're planning to proceed today is we have two items on the agenda. Actually, one of them is to discuss, do a walkthrough or discuss the potential amendments to House Bill 2017. There's a document on the dais in front of each of you that goes over, that's an omnibus list of that. And then there's that's also available on the list. And there's some copies in the back of the room, if anybody in the room would like one. And then the other topic for discussion is to discuss what topics the committee would like to have come before them, you know, beginning as early as next January legislative days, and then that should be everything we have to do today, Mr. Chair.
And committee, my recommendation, I think co-chair agrees, is that we obviously need one bill, the fix-it bill, and we can talk about what that needs to be into that. We have the option of introducing three committee bills. Rather than to get hung up on what those need to be now, perhaps we can have Patrick just put in placeholder bills so that we have them. Is that generally acceptable to everybody?
Yes and no. Nothing like coming in late and having an opinion.
That's why we're here, Senator.
Yeah, right. How many bills do we think they're going to be? If Patrick is, what you just said suggested to me that there were going to be multiple bills.
Mr. Chair.
These are placeholder ideas, not placeholder bills. They would all the ideas would go in the fix-it?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we could do it all in one bill, of course. Yes, we have at this time a document that has roughly 21 pages of potential amendments that could be adopted. And so those could be all in a single one relating to transportation. Everything would probably fit in there. We could at some point decide that some of them are things you have to do and so maybe you could make a choice to break them up and do some of the have-tos and then consider some of the want-tos kind of as a separate one. The problem is that by next Tuesday is the deadline for us to make a decision about whether it's after next Tuesday. It's an academic question because we'll only have whatever we've submitted alleged council to have drafted as of next Tuesday.
Senator, what I might suggest too is there may be a difference between a fix-it bill, which is just basically technical fixes, and some things that have more of a nuanced policy piece, and maybe we want two bills to do it that way.
Okay, because I'll bet you that this panel is about ready to pop with ideas of things that we would like to see added at this point. And if Patrick is going to be the scrivener to gather the ideas,
and we may end up doing something like that. What was real clear to me is that I don't want to impose on members who haven't seen this before to try to be making a decision today.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair.
I think we just wanted to make sure it's here. Yeah. And if we do the placeholder, one of the decisions, you know, your comment kind of suggests to me that there are, when Patrick and I were talking about these, they kind of fall into three areas. One of them are pretty clearly just technical issues that I don't think we have any controversy on. There's a second bunch. They're sort of technical, but they're, as the staff in the different agencies have looked at that, they said, well, we think this is what you mean, but that's not what the bill says, and you can do it this way or you can do it that way. That's a different kind of thing. And then there's the third set that you kind of suggested, Senator. There's a few ideas that I think people might want to throw in that as you look at the list and say, how about this? So by having it in having the three bills out there, we could make a decision. And after you look at it, I would appreciate hearing back from you or through Patrick or email to two of us saying this is the way you think you ought to do it so that we have a clean slate that we can kind of start with to work on there. So that's kind of the notion, if that's acceptable to the committee. I'm seeing no shaking here. Senator or Representative Lively, I don't know if you caught all of that.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, then, we will do three. We will introduce three placeholder bills. And Patrick, I cut you off. Do you want to walk us through this thing?
How many do, Mr. Chair? How many do we get?
Three.
Okay.
Just like all other committees.
Okay.
Yes, and I believe because we are a joint committee, Mr. Chair, technically you'll have to have your vice chair or vice chairs agree to at least one of them. But since they're all placeholders, that probably won't be an issue.
I think they're pretty agreeable.
Yeah, that's the Senate. According to Senate rules, we have to have buy-in from the vice chair or chairs.
Okay, for the record, this one's fine. You feel better about yourself, Patrick?
Absolutely, yeah.
We have a protocol that we've established while they are vice chairs. We've tended to work as four chairs. Mm-hmm. And I would hope we're continuing that bipartisan approach to transportation.
Only this topic.
I don't know what that means, but I'm not going there.
I'm not voting for staff and trade.
That's not in this committee.
Can you tell we've missed each other?
I can tell we've been here too long already. Patrick, try.
So Mr. Chair, before I start, the document in front of you is the Omnibus House Bill 2017 Revised Amendments List. Is what it's entitled. Like I said, there's copies at the dais on OLIS. There's some in the back of the room for members in the audience. Where applicable, for each of these items, it's suggested right below the section number. It indicates what entity was who suggested or recommended the proposed amendment or clarification. There are a couple on here that do not have that indication, and the ones that don't date all the way back to the end of session list that came out that Victor Dodier had put together. Many of those are addressed by some of the agencies that have provided input, have also addressed those. There are still some that exist on this list that are kind of arcane holdovers that may not apply to anything anymore, but they're still on here just in memory of Victor, if nothing else.
In memory of Victor.
Not in memoriam of Victor. I shouldn't say that. But since he's not with us today here in this room, so I just thought I'd point that out. So we do have folks from most, if not all, of those agencies that are listed on some of these in the room, so that when we're going through these, anybody has any questions, and you have those questions, they could come up and address what they're thinking with these suggestions.
And I would add to the audience out there, as you look through this list that you're just seeing too, if there are things that you think we've missed or questions you have, please get those to Patrick soon.
Oh, they've been doing it. I got four today, Mr. Chair. So
well, there you go.
So we want to start with at the top, page one.
Excuse me, Senator Bolquist.
And just as usual, I want to clarify so that I don't get blindsided from my left. Madam Christmas. It's not even Thanksgiving yet, okay? Just for a point of clarification, the four co-chairs have sort of seen this on Monday. I mean, there's been no real discussion on our part, no real decision making. We're anticipating and hoping that members will have more time than we have.
I thought I was the only one that got blindsided from the left.
And we'll be able to have input and so on and so forth. So, I mean, if anybody thinks there's a preconceived notion here, there's absolutely nothing here whatsoever. I mean, I did receive a half a dozen of these, and I sent them to Patrick and said, put them in the laundry basket. So thank you for that clarification.
All righty, let's try again, Patrick.
All right, so starting from the top, page one, section 2, sub 3, dealing with fiduciary responsibilities, ODOT suggested that section 2 requires that the commission, that an Oregon Transportation Commissioner not have any direct or indirect financial or fiduciary interest related to the commission's duties. Given the broad definitions, that can be problematic to find commission members who don't have any fiduciary interest in any of these things. So they recommend some small changes removing indirect and fiduciary from the statute to focus on the direct financial conflicts. I term that as a policy change. It may be considered a technical amendment, but that's the first one. The second one, Section 6, long-range plans. Oh, yeah, go ahead.
Really quick, I apologize. Mr. Chair, I came in late. So are we going to have a chance to comment on these one at a time, or do you want us to hold our comments as we're going through these?
As we go?
Yeah, on each one,
okay. We don't want to get into a big debate on these at this point, but if you have a comment or a question, we'll go with that.
Well, let me just ask a clarifying question then on Section 2-3, or subsection 3. So would this prohibit the Oregon Transportation Commission from having someone who's directly knowledgeable about transportation issues, say a trucking company or a shipping company? Say you had a CEO of a shipping company that had expertise. Would this prohibit them from being on the commission?
Mr. Chair, I think that the proposed amendment is designed to try to help prevent that situation from happening.
So the other way to read that is we're going to have a bunch of amateurs running the commission who don't know transportation issues. Congratulations, Director. What am I missing?
I do not think
the
that's
opposite.
The case.
I think it's the opposite.
The concern is that the language as written in the bill might lean more in that direction, and they're suggesting that the amendment would allow for that expertise to be on there.
It would allow for it to be on
yes,
there.
Yes, it would reduce the chances of what you're worried about happening if we make this amendment. Is what
you may recall, it's been a long time, we spent a lot of time talking about that in the committee and in the process. I think generally the intent was you probably, if you were one of the major contractors in the state who were bidding on transportation jobs, you probably wouldn't want to be on the commission.
Correct.
But if you were, you know, someone who used to be or something like that, we wanted not to exclude people who have knowledge.
Well, let me give an example. Gary Neal at the Port of Morrow probably has more knowledge on transportation development than almost anyone in state. Would he be prohibited from being on here?
I don't think so.
Either guys are not blinking. Mr. Chair, let me clarify. I recall this distinctly. And
I think we need clarification
on this one. Here on the Republican side, I can be thrown out to here. This whole clause, if you recall, came about on the discussion of do we want to have prominent city officials or prominent county officials on the board where they're making decisions on distributions to themselves. That's where it came about. And I think that exact discussion that Representative Smith raised up, but what we do want to have is people who are experts on transportation. That's the whole issue. That was if I remember the crux. Sorry to hit the commissioner or the chairwoman out here, but that was the whole issue of this was that whole city county thing. That's where this came from. I agree with Representative Smith. We could certainly lose clarity.
I would agree with that. When you used Mr. Neal as an example, I would find it uncomfortable were he to continue as the executive director of the Port of Morrow and sit on the commission for the perception. But let's take somebody like Martin Callery, retired from the Port of Coos Bay, very knowledgeable in multimodal. I would not want to exclude him.
Yeah, and that was what we were trying to get at. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, obviously, this is an area where, just based on the conversation, we probably need some clarity.
Johnson has a question.
Move on.
Now I got one more. I'm sorry to bog us down.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that whatever strictures we put in place with respect to the commission, that there is some relationship or applicability to what ODOT is doing with their vendors right now. I don't know what prophylactics are in place about conflict within your vendors, and I'm kind of making this up, so forgive me while I stumble around. But if you have somebody doing design, would they then be able to do construction, or is there some kind of a firewall between that?
That's a great point.
No, you wouldn't want to preclude that, or you'd eliminate a couple of the major
half the contracting world. But I just would like to make sure, and this could be explored as we further explore this, that whatever we do with respect to the OTC, it's complementary to what ODOT's doing with their vendors.
We hear you. Okay. I'm going to try and move us on, or we'll never get through this.
Sure, Mr. Chair. The next one, Section 6, long-range plans. Okay. Section 6 of the bill requires ODOT to develop and maintain long-range plans for modes of transportation that do not currently fall under the transportation department's purview, specifically aviation and ports. Their concern is that their funding sources cannot be used for those non-highway mode long-range plans, and therefore they recommend that we try to identify a funding source for that particular requirement of the department to develop and maintain those long-range plans.
Hmm. Yes, sir.
Again, was the idea that ODOT was going to develop and maintain these, even though they were separate from the funding. I find that somewhat problematic, given the plethora of issues that are present in Oregon's 23 ports that have independently elected boards, where ODOT's vision of their future may differ from those publicly elected boards. I think this is a real conundrum. The other issue here is, you know, why not have ODOT responsible for doing TriMet's long-range plan? I don't know why. What was so special about aviation and ports? You have some very high-performing ports that I think would be loath to have ODOT telling them what their future looked like.
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, so I'll read the language from the bill. It requires the department to develop and maintain a comprehensive 20-year long-range plan for safe multimodal transportation system for the state, which encompasses economic efficiency, orderly economic development, and environmental quality. And the plan, the comprehensive long-range plan A, must include but not be limited to aviation, highways, mass transit, ports, rail. So it's an overall plan that includes features of all those modes.
So they would accept the strategic plan. We might as well stick with the Port of Morrow. So they would accept the strategic plan of the Port of Morrow and incorporate it into that 20-year vision?
Exactly. The discussion that we had on this was, everybody's got their plans are out there. How are we integrating these plans together at the state level to ensure that resources from the state are going to the port of X or the port of Y, and we're building this freeway first and we're doing that first? That was the intent. The question is whether the language accomplishes that. Representative Smith has a question to the right.
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. So is anyone concerned about the timing of these plans, considering the fact we're about to spend $60 million on several intermodal facilities prior to the state creating its long-range plans for intermodal activity?
Well, hopefully you're right.
Would it make sense for us to perhaps have the plan first and then look at how to invest $60-plus million? Just a thought.
I can't believe you're suggesting
that. No, I can't either. You have a drink on you, Senator?
Get it.
An intermodal.
Yes, that would be a discussion we should have.
I hope the media's catching this.
We will be stuck where there is no mud, and we have just appropriated a lot of money with the idea of getting projects on the ground. And while I appreciate the notion of comprehensive and thorough planning,
I'll stick quiet.
We gotta get this puppy off the runway.
Moving right along.
So, if I may, Mr. Chair, Section 10, page 2, that deals with the Continuous Improvement Advisory Committee. This is one of those holdovers from the original list. I don't think anybody's raised any concerns. There was a suggestion that there were no sideboards on groups that should comprise the term transportation stakeholders. Nobody's really raised a concern about that. I think we feel it's an issue that will resolve itself. So that one we'll just skip through. Section 11 and 12, the city reporting on transportation infrastructure. This was brought by Craig Honeyman from the League of Oregon Cities. Under the bill, on Section 11, it requires that all cities and counties provide information to the Department of Transportation on the state of their transportation infrastructure, and then that information will be put on the state website. There are structures that specify that if they fail to report their information to the Transportation Commission, that they may not receive any payments from the State Highway Fund until the report is filed. The specific issue that that Craig brought up was that there is language in ORS 366-790, which specifies that the cities report annually on expenditures and transportation funds. That language in current statute before House Bill 2017 exempted cities under 5,000 in population. And because that seemed to conflict with the requirement that all cities in Section 12 of this bill report, he thought maybe a simple strike all cities and just specify cities that are subject to this requirement. However, since that conversation I had with him, and unfortunately Craig was unable to be with us today, since that conversation I spoke with Heidi Elliott and Ledge Council, she suggested that one way to do it the opposite direction is simply add a notwithstanding clause in this. But, of course, looking at the section again, Section 11 already has that. So, I mean, under the bill is fine as it is, except that from the League of Oregon Cities perspective, it imposes a requirement that could be onerous for small cities, of which there's lots of them. Two-thirds of the cities in the state fall underneath that 5,000 population threshold.
So for purposes today is just flagging that that's an
yes,
issue.
Yeah,
we'll
that's
have
correct.
It, and there's a
yeah.
policy choice there that we'll have to make in February.
Yes, exactly. Okay. So we can move on then. Sections 14 and 80, dealing with proximity to aggregate sites. We added that information. We had a lot of discussion on that in committee during session. The projects would be, there'd be an additional indicator or criteria to be considered for projects about whether their proximity to an aggregate site, with the desire to prevent the cases of having to haul rock for long distances across the state to get to sites that are funded. ODOT brought a recommendation that suggested removing the considerations language related to proximity of aggregate sites on EFU land in both sections 14 and 80. I suspect I could go into more detail, but if you have any questions about that, you could ask them on that one.
Could be raised here later.
I just want to flag this one, that I would need to know a whole lot more before I would want to support ODOT's recommendation, respectfully, Mr. Director. And I have to say I'm motivated by a very parochial interest in that there is a huge multimodal opportunity in Clatsop County that could create a number of jobs at the Westport Ferry, and I don't want to surrender that without a lot more conversation.
Ditto.
Representative? Well, I agree with everything that's been said. On this part, though, we've had a number of conversations regarding a couple of good ideas have come up. One is that, at the least, we would have ODOT call out on a reporting basis how far we're having to haul aggregate now, because I think in some cases it's absolutely ridiculous how much money we're spending on hauling rock for such huge distances, and we need to at least be calling that out. The other thing is that OCAPA is interested in working on language here that would address this issue in more detail, and I'm happy for that help. So, yeah, to be continued.
The concern, when we recall, the concern we had is really one that the representative just voiced there in terms of we don't want to spend most of the money hauling rock long distances if we can get it closer.
That's
and trying to
correct.
And obviously, I think we have some conflict with some of the land use laws that we need to resolve.
Yeah.
And looking for ideas.
So, Mr.
Moving
Chair,
on.
The next one, Section 20, Sub 2. You'll notice, I think on all of these documents, the highlighted ones are issues that I think are specifically technical fixes that we already know the answer to. This is one of them. It's just the Ledge Council identified a couple of cross-references that need to be added related to Section 20, Sub 2. So probably don't need to talk about that.
They
would just be added added sections that would address that. Section 32 and 33, Department of Transportation flagged that. They indicated that there is an incorrect reference related to electric and hybrid vehicles. And so they recommended a change on that. That's another technical fix, so we probably don't need to talk about that anymore. That would be one that we would do as a matter of course. The next one up is Section 34, registration fee increases. This is another holdover to the original list that was developed at the end of session. It was there was an indication that some of those increases may have been high enough to warrant a review by the committee to see if they were maybe increased too much. So we just flag that, and the committee can consider that on its own time. The next one, 34 sub 10, 34 sub 14, and 35 sub 10, applicable vehicles to registration fees. The Department of Transportation noted that government vehicles were inadvertently left off all three of those lists, and so should be added an added vehicle classification to each of those three lists.
Okay.
So that would be a technical fix. The next technical fix was recommended by Garrett Kransky of the Street Trust, who noted that the bill references the Bicycle Transportation Alliance in Cycle Oregon. The BTA has now changed its name to the Street Trust, and so he provided us the correct language on that.
Okay.
So that's another technical fix.
Question to the left, please.
And I have one that is not a technical fix, but a substantive fix. For many of us that are very supportive of the Capital Foundation, I am informed that the Pacific Wonderland plates are running out. Mm-hmm. And if we don't get them re-upped, we will be taking money from the Capital Trust, Capital Foundation.
Later on the list?
It is not later on the list, but because it's an issue not directly related to information that's in there, but that has been a topic, another policy option that has been consideration that could be added to this list.
I would very much like to do that. I'd spoken to the chair about it. Yeah. I just saw the specialty plates, and it was a target of opportunity.
Yeah, just because it isn't referenced anywhere in House Bill 2017 is the reason.
Would this be a place that if we were going to add it, we would just do it as part of that?
It would be somewhere in that
okay,
section,
let's
I think.
Let's just plan on doing it.
Yeah. All right, next up is Section 45, Conditional Fuel Tax Increases. Well, actually, this next group is very kind of complex and complicated. Set of recommendations that Department of Transportation has weighed in on. There's some of the language that's in this next section is some of it that's a holdover from the original list, and some of it is recommendations that were brought by the Department of Transportation. Those actually start on page 5. They note that the reporting criteria change from year to year. I don't know if the Department of Transportation has any interest in talking about. Do you have any ability to come up and talk about these particular changes, Leah, in sections in section 45?
Actually, could we get? I mean, if we're going to consider that, maybe you could do a briefing paper for us rather than trying to do it all verbally now, so we know what you're talking about.
So they don't mess it up.
Yeah, we just. Yes, that probably is all we would need is follow-up information at a later time.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So then the next one, Section 52, road use assessment. That was another one that was a holdover that was just flagged. It's an increase that might be that's a significantly sizable that the committee might want to review to see if that increase in the road use assessment was too high or the right level. So that's been flagged as well.
Okay.
Sections 54 through 58. This is an interesting one. This one was actually brought by Bob Russell on behalf of the Oregon Trucking Associations. But there were some fee increases that apparently during the negotiations of how the fee increases for heavy trucks would be developed for this, it was the desire of the trucking associations that those that the fee increases fall entirely into the weight mile tax.
Right.
But Bob indicated that there were some increases in sections 54 through 58 that amount to roughly $300,000 a year of revenue. He said that were increased despite that, and so it was his request or recommendation that those be. That those increases be eliminated in order to kind of maintain what was discussed prior to the bill being passed.
Matt, on these that are flagged like that, if you guys could give us some background in writing so when we consider we know what, have a little more detail on that.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so... So then Section 71A and 71B, this one was also brought by the Department of Transportation. So Section 71A provides distribution for the increases in the fuel taxes, registration fees, weight mile taxes, specifies that a certain percentage go to safe routes to schools, and the state set aside $10 million for safety, and then the rest be used as follows, 40% for bridges, 30% seismic, 24% pavement, and 6% for maintenance. The department has suggested that the change of percentages allocated so that they fall 40, 40, 20. They indicated that this won't result in any actual changes to where money's going. It's just for optics, I think, is what you said. It will maintain what's been the traditional breakdown, but that it won't actually, the fact that the numbers, the percentages are being changed, won't have any functional differences in how the money's reallocated. It will just be consistent with what has been the case in the past. Because there have been people who have asked questions about why the percentages have changed. Whereas functionally the percentages haven't changed. It's just they were re kind of organized in such a way to Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely not. Okay. Huh? That's okay. We'll go on.
Section 71D sub 1 is another thing that was suggested by Ledge Council. There was some clarifying language that they suggested adding to that that will make it function the way it's supposed to. Next page, page 8, section 71D sub 2. This was brought by the Department of Transportation. They just noted a typo in that section, so we'll fix that.
I'm sorry.
Oh, we're on the top of page 8. Yeah, so the section 71 D sub 2 is just a technical spelling correction.
Mr. Chair, that Terrebonne should be replaced with what is that, Heppner?
Yeah.
What?
It should be Heppner?
Yeah. I just checking. Sorry.
I'm trying to make up ground. You're worth the videotapes in your district already, aren't you?
Oh, he wants to give our project away.
So the next one, 71F, this one was flagged at the end of session as well. It was noted that the multimodal projects that are distributed money by Section 71F distributes money to the projects but does not indicate the order in which those projects are to be funded in the event that more than one is ready to move before the money is available for them. I think that we are of the opinion that this is not an issue. That the one project that's likely to go first will have the money for that, and then the other projects will be significantly later. But hopefully, all things being equal, we will have time to deal with that.
So just be clear on the understanding. Our understanding when we were discussing this is that the Ontario project was ready to go, and my understanding is that is indeed the case. The other projects we were assuming would take longer and would be in future budgets. So there are some smaller, I can't remember them, but mm-hmm. I think that's what they're talking about, is if there isn't enough money, how does that go? The other one I should tell you is that the co-chairs and vice chairs have submitted a letter to the co-chairs of Ways and Means suggesting that since the lottery funds are up, that perhaps we ought to refill the Connect Oregon Fund a little higher. Who knows what it's going to happen with this, but the request is in.
And just for succinct clarity, I mean, the co-chairs and the chairs understood that probably maybe as early as December that the Ontario project might be prepared to start moving forward, and we confirmed with ODOT that they were prepared to implement if that in fact came true. Okay, thank you.
You want to talk?
That's correct.
You want to talk? Come on up. Yes. Representative?
Yeah, really quick before the director begins. I just want to share with committee members why we're not voting here. I have a potential conflict of interest. Colleagues, I'm a member of a limited liability company that does economic and business development around the state of Oregon. And there's potential projects in here that our company working on.
You're very consistent in putting that on the record. Thank you very much.
We're very consistent and start digging by December.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It has been made abundantly clear that they're first among equals with the four earmarked Connect Oregon projects, and the Treasure Valley project is first out of the chute. There's a math issue that was spoken to. I think the issue, Senator Bocas, you broached the December timeframe. December 15th is a significant day in terms of an applicant for the money to put forth a pre-proposal saying they stand ready to move forward. That allows us to continue the process to eventually allocate the money if all the appropriate disciplines and criteria that is will come to my transportation commission are met. But there, again, it's been made abundantly clear, and I think if you go back to July, the legislative intent moves at Ontario Treasure Valley project first.
That's our strategic plan, right?
Yeah. I should note for the record that our legislators request, mine particularly, but I believe concurred, the director has assigned a specific ODOT staff person to work those projects.
Correct.
The sort of directions, and if possible, make it so.
Following the rules. Everybody.
Following the rules. Notwithstanding.
Anyway, thank you.
The senator has a question over here.
I'm curious. Is that the ombudsperson for all of 2017, or is that the ombudsperson for the two transloads facilities?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, the ombudsman specifically for the Valley conversation, just continuity. There's several discussions going on there. I want to make sure that all entities know that they have an ODOT person to help facilitate a conversation to get the answers they may need from the appropriate professionals within my agency or outside, maybe some of our sister agencies. We do have a project manager overseeing the whole of House Bill 2017, applying, again, rigorous project management discipline to ensure we're sweating both the big stuff as well as the small stuff.
Two comments. One of them is, who is the transload guru?
There's a gentleman by the name of Jay Purdwell.
Oh, okay. Question number two is, I think that the keeper of the flame around answering the questions with respect to 2017 is a very sound idea. Otherwise, you're going to have 90 legislators that look like a box of mice calling their district manager or their region manager with a lot of specific questions. And I would just hope that whoever is charged with fielding the calls with respect to House Bill 2017 keeps kind of a running list. It may be instructive as to the kind of questions that are asked or the number of times the same question is asked that we haven't hit the mark. And who's assigned that loftiest task?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, vector control was one of the skill sets we asked for. Young woman by the name of Kat Silva is on point for us.
Cool. One more. Mm-hmm. What effort have you made to educate legislators and or other interested Oregonians that there now is air traffic control for this and who it is and how to reach them? I think it's going to cut down on the wear and tear of your staff out in the regions enormously, but you got to get the word out.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, that's an excellent point. Again, we're, 30-some days since we went live with this bill. I think we're putting together all the constructs in terms of the 40-plus initiatives that we have identified, the responsibilities and obligations of individuals within my agency, outside of my agency. We're putting together the construct. We'll get that information out. We'll have a source for people to come to bring the discipline that you just articulated.
Actually, an FAQ on your website might be a good idea.
That's actually part of the mix. You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, next up, Section 71L, quarterly reports. Much like the Jobs and Transportation Act, Section 71L requires quarterly reports to the Legislative Assembly on the estimated amount of revenue received as a result of the increases in taxes in this bill. ODOT indicated that they do not believe that the reports for the JTA's quarterly reports have been significantly valuable enough to warrant quarterly reports, and recommend that both for JTA and for Section 71L, that those reports be made semi-annually instead of quarterly.
Well, I would probably actually disagree with that. I think we would like to have you in front of the committee on every legislative day and hear what's going on.
You know, I'm offended by Senator Johnson's mice comment. Rats, we want to know what's going on the ship. This ain't JTA.
Keep the mice happy. Okay, moving right along.
Next page, Section 73, Sub 2, Sub B. This is an actual interesting technical fix. So when originally the bill was drafted and enacted, the formula for calculating the small county allocation, the numbers were reversed. The numerator and denominator were accidentally reversed. So in this case, one of the technical fixes will be to correct that. It's a change that is necessary to make the program work as designed. So,
just thinking back, didn't we just adopt the language they gave us?
AOC indicated that the language they gave to the Ledge Council was incorrect, and so that is correct. All of that. That's a pretty easy fix. The next one is one that actually probably isn't an issue. It was something brought up by the Department of Aviation. It was clarification about project selection in Connect Oregon Part 2. But we, the working group last week, believed that we satisfied them that there's no concern there. So we'll just skip that one. Okay. Section 84, Sub 1, the Parks account sub-account transfer is actually an issue that's been brought up by a couple of people, the Parks Department and others. That for the $4 million transfer for bike ped projects in Connect Oregon, from the Parks Department. The department has suggested that the measure's language clarify the allocation be made from within the 12% of lottery funding dedicated to local outdoor recreation improvement projects in cooperation with the Department of Transportation to align with Connect Oregon goals. They have also suggested that that particular section be sunset on January 3rd, 2023, which would then end that transfer. I didn't get an indication from them about the rationale for the sunset change, but I do think that there's that the actual change, it's I've heard that the actual this change in terms of where within the Parks Department budget the money would come from is also a potential bone of contention, so we'll be looking closer at that as
that
well.
Was work on that.
That was a discussion they raised during the work group process, and at least my response was no. It's off the top.
So anyway, we can talk about it during
February.
The next one, I believe, is also a technical change. It's the report on Connect Oregon streamlining. That report was technically due September 15th of this year by the statute, but of course that was just a mistaken date. So Legislative Council is going to, I believe ODOT's ready to present that either in writing or they could, I guess, present it when next we meet in January if it's the chair's desire to do that. And then, so the Office of Legislative Council just suggested that they amend the language to reflect when that report's actually presented rather than make it look like they missed a date, which was an incorrect date to begin with.
I understand the technical correction that you're speaking to, but this streamlining of the Connect process holds the attention of a lot of us that have been around Connect since it was first started. I don't know how much policy change we're expecting from ODOT in change of criteria or queuing or what the rules of engagement will be on Connect, and I'm curious to know whether or not there are going to be substantive changes.
They're shaking their head no. Okay. I'm Senator. So, yeah, so that report should be forthcoming relatively soon. But we can have, like I said, we can make a decision whether that report is presented orally to the committee in January or if we just get the paper report. But
I would respectfully ask that there be a presentation with the opportunity to ask some questions.
Yeah. Okay.
If you can do it in January, that'd be great.
Yeah. Okay.
And maybe we'll just then, rather than changing the date, just take that out of the report.
Well, that was suggested. That was suggested that that we could. That was one possible solution.
Okay.
Just leave it as is, or take it out completely. But so we can worry. We can worry about that.
So the concern was. The concern is we're asking directly to report before the bill became law.
Right.
Right. And before the committee was actually appointed.
I hate it when we do that.
So the next couple of changes deal with the definition of bicycle and taxable bicycle for in terms of the bicycle excise tax. There were a couple issues raised by the Department of Revenue. One of them is that the definition of 26-inch diameter bicycle wheels, some bicycle wheels aren't 26 inches. They're something close to 26 inches, but less than it's the metric or the metric conversion. So they're going to come up with some suggestions on how we could specify it by the European measurement.
Or the equivalent European measurement.
They also noted that there are some children's bicycles that have bicycle tires that are slightly bigger than that.
Right.
And there are, and of course, recumbent bicycles in some cases. Oh, that's another one that's coming up, I think.
Good.
Recumbent bicycles in some cases. The other thing that the bill refers to is wheels, plural, greater than 26 inches. There are some expensive recumbent bicycles that have a wheel that's bigger than that, but the rest of the wheel or wheels are smaller than that. So there's got to be some clarification there too. And those are I think those are technical fixes that we'll make. And then they're going to help us with that or work with the folks that can help us with that. The other thing that is that electric assisted bicycles currently fall into the taxable motor vehicle category. But it's unlikely that there will be many of them there. Many of them are not sold by entities that are subject to the vehicle privilege tax, so they wouldn't be taxable in that way. So they are recommending that we remove electric assisted bicycles from taxable motor vehicles, which would be subject to the privilege tax, and instead move them into the definition of bicycles so that they would become subject to the bicycle excise tax. And that roughly, I think the calculation is a bicycle that's valued at $2,000 would pay exactly at $2,000, the tax is the same for the 0.5% privilege tax as it is for the $15 tax. Anything over that would be slightly less. Anything under that would be slightly more. But that's their recommendation that.
There's more of those out there now than they think there are.
Right. And so that was their recommendation on that, and I think that probably makes a level of sense. And then they also had a recommendation dealing with the definition of new motor vehicle for the privilege tax, specifically related to the issue about trailers and the fact that trailers don't meet would be problematic because they don't have an odometer, and the reference in statute to new motor vehicle is a reference that includes a new motor vehicle that's being registered for the first time and has an odometer reading of 7,500 or less. Trailers don't have odometers. It was brought up at the chair's meeting yesterday that maybe it was never the intent for trailers to be involved in the privilege tax at all.
Right.
And that's a concern that kind of makes this moot, but raises some other questions that Mazin, I think, is going to have to look into in terms of what effect on the revenue estimates for the privilege tax taking trailers and non-motorized vehicles out would have. There was also discussion yesterday about recreational vehicles, mm-hmm. I think, and motorcycles as well.
What the intent was
versus what the language that was adopted and enacted by the legislature was. So that's the whole definition of new motor vehicle, I think, something that you all will be talking about for a while in the future, right? So so we can push past that a little bit. The next section, 89.3(3), deals with the definition of retail sales price. That's another issue that's become kind of complicated. When we met yesterday, the Department of Revenue discussed whether the trade-in value for a vehicle that's traded in would be subtracted from the retail price before calculation of the privilege tax. I believe Senator DeBoer brought up yesterday the question about whether rebates that are received and taken off of the price of the vehicle at purchase would also be subtracted from the price before calculation of the privilege tax. I don't know that we answered any of those questions yesterday.
No, we're still working on it.
So those are issues that are still to be worked on.
But we did raise the issue of the target that we sent for the revenue that would be collected from the privilege tax, and as we begin to deal with these issues, that may become a topic of conversation.
And then the third change dealing with the privilege tax that the Department of Revenue suggested, I've classified this as a technical fix, but we'll see what you all think about it. So the bill defines vehicle dealer as an entity licensed by Oregon DMV as a vehicle dealer. However, they noted that there are persons who may unlawfully sell a taxable motor vehicle without a license, when a license is required, and therefore that sale would not, according to the bill, be subject to the privilege tax because it's being sold by an entity that's not a licensed entity. They recommend that you could address that by changing the definition of vehicle dealer to include persons that are engaged in business that are subject to licensure rather than, say, by entities that are licensed, and that would address that issue. So that may or may not be a technical fix, but it looked like one to me, so I marked it as such. Let's see. So, I guess we're not necessarily done with the privilege tax. So 90 and 91, also Department of Revenue, deal with leased vehicles.
That's more complicated.
It is pretty complicated. It turns out that leased vehicles, vehicles that are leased, are not necessarily leased to the user by an entity that is subject to the privilege tax. There's also some issue about whether or not where the transaction happens between the manufacturer and the end user, and whether it's a wholesale price or a retail price. So there's a lot of questions that need clarification around that as well.
That's one. Representative Benson had indicated that there may be a way to connect it to UCC filings.
Okay.
Should be a point of doing
that. I turned to look at him, but I forgot.
He's not there. He's on his way.
Mr. Dale was tasked to research.
Yeah, so we have staff and ledge council who's going to be looking into that as well. So now we're moving on to page 13, imposition of excise tax on bicycles. This is a recommendation from legislative council that we just may need to clarify the language about what valid receipt given to the purchaser by the seller means. So we'll probably be making some, they will probably be making some legislative recommendations on that. The next one is dealing with more back to the privilege tax by the Department of Revenue. So exemptions, there are no exemptions currently for sales to governmental entities such as state, county, cities, school districts, etc. And the state is prohibited from taxing the federal government under the supremacy clause, but the privilege tax would seem to apply to organ dealers that sell to federal agencies. So there are some issues that they believe require some clarification, and I imagine we will have them helping us through some of those issues as well.
Okay.
Those may end up being technical fixes as well. So now we're to Section 100, sinking due dates for remitting use and excise taxes. Back to the Department of Revenue again. So that deals with because many customers will learn about the use tax when they try to register their vehicle. Department of Revenue recommends modifying the due date for consumer vehicle use tax to 30 days following the date of purchase. That syncs up with some current timing that the DMV uses. So that's a change that I classified as a technical fix that will just make it fit in with timelines that are already being met when you're doing stuff with DMV. Now we're on to page 14, section 111, sub 2. The Office of the Legislative Council noted that there was a need to clarify language around the local government tax moratorium. So we just listed that as a technical fix. They will come up with the language to do that, just to make it work the way it's supposed to. Okay. 118A, this was suggested by Department of Transportation. I listed this also as a technical fix. We did not in the bill address the step increases in the gas tax and how those would affect or should affect the road usage charge, which is based to be analogous to 20 mile per gallon in gas tax in terms of how it's charged. So they recommended instead of having steps to instead do a formula that would be the fuels tax rate divided by 20 equals the road usage charge rate. And so each time that's increased, then that formula would capture that. And so that's, they list that as a technical fix. I think that falls into a technical fix as well. The next one on the page is section 118C sub 3, which is the electric vehicle opt-in. It was recommended by the Department of Transportation that for electric vehicles that are already enrolled in the ORGO program at the time of the vehicle registration renewal or registration renewal notice, they are not charged the enhanced registration fee by DMV. And, you know, the bill requires, the bill includes higher registration surcharges for electric vehicles than for other classes of vehicles. And so there will be some language that would clarify that vehicles that are enter the ORGO program are exempt from that, from those surcharges.
Yes?
Color me cynical. This is not my favorite program, and I don't know what the motivation is, whether this is to drive people into ORGO to buck up the numbers and create a safe harbor. I just want to suggest that unless I know more about it, I'm going to have a lot of trouble with this one.
Okay. Duly noted.
Sure. All right, so next page, section 122L through R. There was a recommendation from long ago that suggested, do we really want to stick with Statewide Transportation Improvement Fund as the name for the transit fund that's being created? I think that ship's far enough out of dock that we're not going to go and consider changing the name of the STIF then. Is that a fair, are we all kind of agreed on that? That when we first passed it in July, I think there was some discussion about maybe finding a new name for it, but
it's,
is anybody interested in doing that?
The STIF and the STIP.
I'm
not buying new stationery.
All right, so let's see. So the next one.
Yeah, they will. They got it for everything. Right?
The next one is a recommendation from the Department of Transportation related to the STIF. So, because the department doesn't have, can't use state highway funds to pay for transit work and doesn't have adequate other funds to pay for administration costs, they recommend adding a language to allow the agency to use 1% of the funds from the STIF to pay for the administrative costs out of the funds collected. So the Department of Transportation is administering this. They cannot use their current funding stream to pay for the program, so they're looking to use some of the money from the STIF to pay for administration of the program.
Set aside a percent to the department for the money for that purpose.
I recall.
Could have been in draft 9 or 10.
Certainly talked about it.
You did.
Yeah.
But it was for the technical resource center.
Well, I assume that would cover both.
Right. Well, I think that is exactly where we need to explore. Let us get a better understanding on how that plays itself out. If it's the right color of money, then maybe we move forward on it. We want to make sure we do have the right color of money and a color of money that we can
so
bring
people on. So you just want a clarification on that? Do you need it in statute?
I think let us, over the next couple months, work this thing.
Okay, we'll see if it's necessary. I mean, that was the, I will tell you, that was the thought.
If that was the intent, that
to cover the administration and that.
Okay. Question to the left.
Yes.
Would this apply to all transit, or are you going to have them turning on each other and saying we ought to be exempt?
No, this only applies to the department. The total funds that come off of the payroll tax, 1% of it, the department gets to keep to provide technical assistance and administer the program.
Right. I understood that. I'm expressing an interest in having this apply equally to the great big guys, Chariots, and the little bitty guys, Hepner Go Fast, or whatever it's called.
I don't think we had a requirement on them.
Right.
On Hepner Go Fast?
nor Chariots. Their requirement is to create a plan that demonstrates connectivity and extended reach, extended frequency, and addressing low income.
Okay. Having not been at Ground Zero in the conversation, I really am confused. If we are allowing ODOT to use 1% of the funds to pay for the administrative funds of all the funds collected, are there going to be opt-outs for certain transit providers, or will this apply across the board?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Johnson, I think it's for the specific standing up of a resource center that will actually act as capacity for probably the smaller providers across the state of Oregon. And I think that was the intent. And I think the clarification Chair Beyer broached saying that was to cover the administrative cost helps inform the discussion on this specific section.
Our assumption when we talked about it was particularly in the rural areas, there was going to be a need to help them put systems together and to have the connectivity with the state buses and like that. That's what it was for, as well as do the administration.
Yeah, I'm very supportive of that.
And a little bit of battling is go whatever. And others want to have their own systems, which I think we were saying, no, we don't want that. We want a coordinated system in the rural areas.
Good.
Your argument all the time.
One more question over here, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair, really quick, I want to go back to Section 121L. I kind of brushed over that as we're visiting. For a lot of folks who are small town city council members or kind of new to transportation, I think you will find that there's a confusion between the STIP and the STIF.
The STIF. Yes.
And so while we kind of made light of that, I do think that's something we ought to put a star next to.
I agree.
Okay.
Okay, moving on.
So there's one other issue that came up on Section 122L specifically. TriMet raised the indication that they are working on developing a low-fare system, which is part of what Section 122 is designed to do, low-fare assistance system. They have heard that there may be an indication from Department of Justice that the language in 122L sub 1 that specifies that except that monies may not be used for light rail may be read to mean that they cannot use the STIF monies for low fare assistance, because some of those riders will be riding light rail. So they recommend adding the word capital after light rail so that it will specify that the money from the stiff can't be used for light rail capital.
Well, that, I remember that issue very much, and Senator Boquist was very strong on that. It's in order to get it passed that we couldn't use the money for the capital, but I don't think there's any the objection to operating.
We didn't receive any objection, but I mean, as long as we're adding the word capital, it's fine. Yeah.
That's the only suggestion on that. So, okay, so that's fine. So then,
I'm very much in support of that change.
I thought you would be.
Well, it's really important because a lot of people I represent, if they get the low income help, I mean, they jump on MACs, not just buses.
Yeah.
I have to clarify that either one is covered.
It'd be a nightmare administratively as well.
Oh, it'd be horrible.
Right, separated, yeah.
We'd lose more money.
Sure, and they get passes that are good for the whole transit system.
Okay.
So the next one on here was a concern that was raised by Smart Transit in the city of Wilsonville that my conversation with Legislative Council this morning may have solved. I think it deals with the definition of public transportation service provider. I believe that they were concerned that was going to affect their ability possibly to receive monies from the 90% distribution of the stiff. My conversation with Office of Legislative Council this morning may have solved that issue. So we'll look into that a little bit more, and if it hasn't solved it, we'll bring that back to you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Sections 122 N through P, oversight of transit providers, that was one that's a holdover. It just said maybe there's not enough oversight in there. I don't know if that's a concern. There's a lot of oversight in House Bill 2017. But that was flagged early on, so we can maybe skip over that one.
Okay.
22 O was another subject that was brought up at the end of session about adding criteria about how the advisory committees, the local transit advisory committees, were set up. The rulemaking on this is happening right now. I think to the extent there's concerns about that, they could be brought up in the rulemaking process, Mr.
Sounds
Chair.
Good.
So we can skip over that one elsewhere. Rest area management was another issue that was brought up at the end of session. I don't know that anybody has raised this concern since then, so we could probably skip that one.
This one resonates with me. There has been a lot of confusion about the government camp and the parking lot and whether or not the sub base in that parking lot is adequate for the trucks that are resting there. This is more complicated than just passing over it, respectfully.
Mm. Okay.
All right.
I'd like the opportunity to at least do a little more insight, and
sure.
I would volunteer to get the problem statement.
Okay.
Excellent.
You can take the whole page, Madam Senator.
Thank you.
So I think the next one, Section 134, jurisdictional transfers, was another one that was flagged but hasn't had any indication that we need to go in and change the numbering from that section again. So we can probably skip over that one,
okay.
Mr. Chair. Section 147, severability, that was brought by the Department of Transportation. There are portions of the bill that are specifically that if portions of the bill are found unconstitutional or the constitutionality of the use of them are challenged successfully, that those sections will be repealed. However, ODOT has noted that while those sections would be repealed, there are other sections that would not be repealed that would still impose work requirements on the department that would then become moot with the repeal of the sections in question. So there was some desire to clarify the expectations of the agency surrounding the programs that would be repealed should that challenge occur. So we'll look into how to make those work, Mr. Chair. All right, now we're on page 18. So this is sections 148 through 150. These were brought by Department of Environmental Quality. They suggested that because the sections relating to the EV rebate program are not made part of ORS 468 or 468A or otherwise linked to DEQ's statutory authority to develop enforcement mechanisms, the provisions and requirements of the bill relating to the rebate eligibility and use cannot be enforced by DEQ as written, so that there should be language added to clarify that those sections are to be made part of ORS 468 or 468 or otherwise some way to ensure that DQ can use its enforcement mechanisms as necessary to make the bill work as it's supposed to. Okay. So I listed that as a technical fix as a result. And the next one also by DQ is related to the cap for zero emission vehicles and the charge ahead rebates. Sections 148 and 149 establish a conventional cash on the hood rebates for EV purchases or leases, and the sections limit rebates to be used on qualifying vehicles with a base MSRP of $50,000 or less. But there is no similar cap of $50,000 or less for the charge ahead rebates. And so the issue is whether it's the intent of the cap to apply to both the conventional and charge ahead rebates or just the conventional rebates. So clarification on that would be desired, is whether that cap was meant to apply to both or just to the first. The next one is a list of questions that were raised at the end of session related to zero emission vehicles, which I believe are addressed in some of the other ones. I think some of the ones I'm going to get to in a minute address those. The one that I didn't, clawback provisions, which I think we're going to get to some clawback provision questions later. So that addresses 148 and 150 on the center of page 19. So the bottom of page 19, applicability of charge ahead rebate to vehicle leases. This is, again, a Department of Environmental Quality question. The definition of charge ahead rebate is limited to the purchase of new and used electric vehicles. While the definition does not mention leases, the rest of the section contemplates the rebates to be used on leases. So it's their understanding that the intent is that the charge ahead rebate be available for purchase and leases. So they recommend clarifying the language as necessary to make sure that that's the case.
I believe that was the discussion.
Okay. So now we're on page 20, which is, I think, was just about done. Page 20 is dealing with the vehicle scrapping requirements. In order for low to moderate income households to access the charge ahead rebate, they must scrap a vehicle that is at least 20 years old. Some stakeholders have asked whether this is in place, why this is in place, and whether it will act as a barrier to the incentivizing the transition to electric vehicles, especially for low-income households who may not want to lose the value of that that car that's being scrapped. Department of Revenue asked whether the committee wanted to consider amending the charge ahead rebate requirement to remove the scrapping requirement, and it would just be that low and moderate income households would qualify for it without scrapping an existing vehicle.
Questions. One, as the driver of one of these beasts, this dinosaur of over 20 years, the idea of having to scrap it is repugnant to me because it has value left in it because it's been well maintained. The other question that I would have is how do you decide what constitutes low and moderate income, and do we set up a great big giant bureaucracy to pour through people's tax returns?
I believe, Madam Chair, that there is a definition of it in Section 150.
Yeah, but what's the standard of proof, and am I lugging in my tax returns? Oh. And I just...
You don't qualify.
Trust me, Betsy.
Yeah, we're pretty sure
that. That may be a question that revenue or DQ might be able to answer. And DQs are available to come answer that question if you like.
Or we can.
Well, he's right there. He's almost half out of his seat already.
This is a policy question that I think we can take up.
Okay. Yeah. Well, our staff can continue to work with the departments as necessary. So we'll.
I just don't like the idea of telling people they got to scrap a car and kiss a value goodbye.
Well, we already did that in the bill.
I must have missed that. One more thing to have bitched about, and I missed the opportunity.
There are a couple.
You bitched. I was there.
There are a couple additional.
This is not one that we liked.
There are a couple additional questions related to that, specifically whether if that scrap requirement were to stay in the bill. There's questions that have been brought up by the Oregon Vehicle Dealer Association that would suggest that maybe we want to clarify whether scrapping a vehicle means not allowing any parts of the vehicle to be to be salvaged for resale by a scrap yard, and whether those parts could include engine parts, or whether the entire engine has to be retired and you could use door panels, or whether you could also recoup some of the parts of an engine and use that to as well. And then also the definition of high emission passenger motor vehicle. There were a couple of questions around that. DEQ had questions about specifically the design primarily for transportation of persons, maybe suggested that change that design primarily for used or purchased primarily for transportation of persons. So that's, but of course, if we get rid of the scrapping requirement, that will become moot, as well as the Daryl Fuller's question on page 21 about whether it applies to pickup trucks and SUVs.
All right. So it seems that there's a whole bunch of policy questions on that.
Well, yes,
that
absolutely.
We'll have to work on.
And then the last two are both just things that would not have to be taken up in a technical fix bill, but were brought forward. They both relate to the budget bill, House Bill 5045, dealing with other funds limitations on DEQ and Department of Transportation having a limitation move through their regular budget process as well. But that won't be in a technical fix bill.
Right.
But they flagged them for the committee's consideration, or at least to notify the committee.
We need to make a recommendation on that. Already, yes, Representative.
I just wanted to say that I felt comfortable not making comments today because I think there's a lot of holes there in information, as well as the differences between the legal and definitional, you know, issues that you have to straighten up the definition. You have to straighten up a legal issue to make it go along with other statutes that we already have. And there are technical ones that are truly technical that would help improve the implementation of this package. But there is a whole bunch of regurgitation of policy discussions that we've already had. Mm-hmm. And I want us to make it very clear that there's three different bills and three different types of amendments. And I don't expect staff to go off and fix it or add more information to those. I expect to have a lot of
that I like where you're going there, but keep in mind that you're pretty much a pretty quick shot at this. We'll have to have language to address in February. Although, as a joint committee, I think we have committees that are only our
that
one
is true. We have till the second chamber deadline to take any action on the bill.
Well, and what I was trying to say, I think January days and everything that we've got coming there, I mean, of course, not in February, not talking about having these long, detailed conversations then.
That's true. I mean, at some point, we have to decide what's in what bill. Which is not to say that when we get into session that we wouldn't amend it and put it back in once we make decisions. Or not.
Right.
We can do it separately.
So flexibility. Is this committee meeting?
Ms. Chair, if you want, we can talk about the reports that are due. That's the other documents that were on OLIS for your consideration are, there's two documents, one by section in the bill and one by dates from which they're due, related to the reports. And there are 18 sections of the bill that deal with reports to this committee or to other legislative committees. The two that would apply theoretically before we go into session in February are the one we talked about earlier, the Connect Oregon streamlining process. And also Section 27C requires the commission to report to this committee and to fiscal and policy committees on the estimated cost to complete I-205, the Abernathy Bridge, and the I-205 widening project. That report is due by February 1st. I don't know if the department is aware or knows whether those reports will be ready in time to present them January 12th when this committee meets or not. It's due by February 1st, so I didn't want to assume that they'd be done by January 10th.
That's an issue we can
But that would be another possible topic for this committee to take up in January or in February, as the case may be, depending on when that report's ready. But then the other question is, what other than that streamlining report, which sounds like we're going to put on the January agenda, do you all want to discuss at this point or wait until a later time to add anything else for January's
agenda? Well, I guess one of the questions for January, I actually had a request from, I don't remember, I think it was the U of O. They wanted to make a presentation to us on the future impact of driverless vehicles. They've done a bunch of research and asked for about 20 minutes on that. Other than that, I think what we're trying to do, and you have it here, Patrick, is the committee work plan. I think all of the reports, whoever they're supposed to go to, I would suggest they may have to go to another committee too, but they should all come to this committee.
Oh, the almost all of them are required to come to this committee,
And that starts our process on a work plan. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I would ask members to think about is we're launching a new joint committee process to provide more oversight of the department. We said in building that accountability, what is it that you would like to have in the way of, you know, a work plan as we go through the interim? And you don't have to necessarily say right now, but it would be good if you could provide that input to Patrick so we can think about that.
I will say mine right now. It came from Full Ways and Means this morning. The Representative Wisnett raised it, and it is the question of geology and who is the final arbiter of geology given the problem in Lapine and the problem with Pioneer Mount Nettyville. And I'd like to flag that one. Is Dogami responsible, ODOT Engineering, or hydrogeology? I just don't know.
Would you like to put that down as a discussion item for January?
I very much would like to do that.
Let's do that.
And so Representative Wisnett, thanks you.
Okay.
Pine and also Pioneer Mountain would be something that would also be applicable.
Well, it's more the topic of how do we do that.
It's the topic of
finding colleges.
Yeah, sure. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I don't want to relitigate Pioneer Mountain, and I think Matt will appreciate that.
Other items? Yes,
Mr. I just want to reemphasize to all the members, it's a unified joint work plan.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter whether you're the Democrat, Republican, House, Senate. If you have something you want placed on the work plan, I mean, the only bad idea is one that you didn't bring forward and you think about later. So please take the time to put some brain power in it and decide what you want to look at over the interim, what are issues you see coming and what are the concerns you have, and get it to either one of the four of us or to Patrick, because there isn't going to be anything rejected.
Senator? Mine is not subject matter specific. It's more a policy question, and that is, this committee is a new construct, and I'm wondering, when other transportation issues are being discussed in other subject matter committees, what effort, if any, will be made to integrate that conversation? Will this committee become the final arbiter of things transportation, or will the body receive other legislation from policy committees that speaks directly to the questions of transportation?
My comment, when we discussed creating this, the model we were using was the Washington Legislative Transportation Committee, which is that's a committee that pretty much has total oversight over the transportation programs of Washington State. So we had a consolidated, clear message to the department and the commission. That's where we were trying to go. There's some balance on that. I will tell you that the discussions I've had on the Senate side with the president, and this is not a decision, it's just discussions, is going into the 19th session, it doesn't make sense to have separate transportation policy committees, that this would be the committee that dealt with those issues. Now, that's obviously up to each chamber to decide as each session starts, but that's kind of the discussion that we've had on the Senate side, and I'll let you talk about the
discussions.
House.
Huh? There's no conclusion, but it has been raised as to how many committees we actually need and how much confusion it creates.
I'm very gratified to hear that, because I think the possibility of complication is great, and people only have so many hours in a day, and the professional lobby, if they're running back and forth between multiple policy committees and this committee, and who makes those jurisdictional calls, in my opinion, it would be easiest to put it all right here.
You're singing my song.
There is no conclusion.
Representative Lively.
Mr. Chair, this is a very important conversation, because I was on the impression what you just expressed to serving on the Accountability Committee when we had these conversations, but that's not the understanding necessarily by all bodies. And I, from my standpoint, think it's the sooner the better that we get some clarity there, not wait until 2019. I tend to agree with Senator Johnson. Because otherwise we're going to be starting the session and maybe have these committees in that and start working doing it. So, but I just know some conversations on our side, there's some confusion about what the intent was. Not, I don't think I was confused what the intent was, but people that weren't part of those conversations are. So.
Well, I think we're pretty close on the Senate side. I'll leave it up to you five on the House side to have that discussion with your leadership. And recognize that constitutionally, every time the session starts, each chamber creates its own rules.
Right. but also a sensitivity to our new chair, who is with us today, the policy committee in the House. So that is what's in place at the moment, and I have not heard that that will change at this point.
The only thing I heard was basically that there was a transitional time, and as you can tell, I mean, we've got a lot of amendments to deal with, technical policy, and there was some feeling that there needed to be a transition time where we might keep both the House and the Senate Transportation Committees to work on other items that are coming along, and there are things that actually are outside of this package that really, so that there might be time for us to do a better, more thorough job here in the first year and a half, 2 years, and then it would go to the second piece of that model that you were suggesting.
Okay. So again, that's kind of where our thinking was. That was the discussion when we were having it during the committee, but again, that's something that you'll have to work out.
Yeah, it's with the presiding officer.
Alrighty, anything else for the good? Good, long meeting. Patrick, you did good. Anything we need to know from the department?
I think we're good, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Alrighty. Cool.
We are adjourned.
Great.
Good work.
Great.
Good work.
All right.
Alrighty.
Cool.
We are adjourned.